Hello, my friends. Angela here. Hey, if you guys haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, you can go to addictionunlimited.com. There's a whole page, subscribe to podcast. It's a list of links to subscribe from any device. On your cell phone, go to the app store, throw a podcast app on your phone. You can subscribe from there. And then take a second to write a review. I'm doing this right now too. I have all these podcasts that I love and I listen to all the time. And I just realized I'm not even writing reviews on my favorite podcasters. So that's something I'm really going to be focused on right now. I hope you guys will do the same. Keep sending the DMs on Insta. Keep sending me the voice messages. I really appreciate you guys. Thanks. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast, where you get to learn everything you want to know about addiction and recovery. I'm your host, Angela Pugh, co-founder of Kansas City Recovery, life coach, and recovering alcoholic. To learn more about me, you can listen to episode zero on your podcast app or find us on the web at addictionunlimited.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Addiction Unlimited podcast. I'm your host, Angela Pugh. We've got another great guest for you today. I'm recording in the beautiful Dallas, Texas. So I have today with me Allison Watros of Windhaven House and Windhaven Counseling. So we're going to hear more from Allison about what she's doing, how she's helping in the addiction industry, and a little bit of her story. Hi, Allison. Welcome to the pod.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. Thank you for doing this for me last minute. I really appreciate that. I had put a shout out on my social media that I was coming down to Dallas and I had three people lined up to record with and all three of my people canceled. So I really appreciate you making time last second to come on and do this. And I'm excited to get to meet you because we have mutual friends that speak very highly of you. So this is a great opportunity. So tell the listeners a little bit about Windhaven House and what you do and the services you provide and all that.
Windhaven House is a female extended care / sober living with high accountability, lots of structure, 24-hour staff. It's a very comprehensive sober living type program. I say sober living type because we are not your traditional sober living. We have 24-hour staff. We do not let our women have cars when they first get here. They have to earn that. So we provide all of their transportation to our IOP, to their appointments, to work once they get a job, to 12-step meetings, etc. And we provide all of their food. We do two Windhaven-specific groups a week for the women that are in the house the whole time they're here, along with IOP the first 7 weeks. And so it's a lot of clinical as well as, 12-step living and the disciplines, body, mind, spirit. We go to the gym. We focus on just healthy living.
Nice.
Yeah.
So obviously your houses are gender specific and you said you have the two groups a week that are Windhaven specific. Does that mean that's only for the women living in the houses or do you also do IOP groups that are open to the community?
Our IOP is open to the community. Our two Windhaven House groups are groups that the women in Windhaven will do the entire time that they're in the house. They'll also have an individual session with their counselor the whole time that they're in the house. So after they've completed IOP, they're still doing two Windhaven-specific groups a week. One focuses on accountability and one is a traditional process group. And so we do that twice a week the entire time they're here. In our IOP, anybody can come to our IOP in the public. And so that's a separate.
Totally separate deal. Mm-hmm. Okay. I know you guys obviously have a lot more structure, which is fantastic. Like you're providing really good services and a lot of support and accountability. Is the core of your sober livings still the same as other sober livings? Like I always say, the core of my sober livings is the same as an Oxford House or something like that, where there's curfew, there's chores, random urine and breath testing. So all of those things remain the same?
Oh, yeah. Drug testing often, breathalyzing, chores, wake up. They have a schedule. They can't sleep in. They have to wake up at 8. I like to say that we let them sleep in because they don't have to get up until 8.
That is sleeping in for some
it is. Morning meditation, chores. Their chores are checked.
Their chores are checked every day?
They're checked every day by staff. So we have day staff and night staff. Yeah, their chores are checked. They get fined if their chores aren't done correctly. Lots of different you know, elements to our program.
Yeah. You are a sober person as well.
I am.
And did you always know that you wanted to work in the addiction recovery industry, or is that something that came to you later?
I did not know that this was going to be where I ended up when I got sober. When I first got sober, I was a licensed real estate agent, although I didn't do very much real estate because I was not equipped.
Right.
Mentally.
Not in the best state
no,
of mind.
No, I wasn't. I tried to be, but I just could never pull it off and had a really hard time answering my phone. So if I don't answer my phone, obviously I'm not going to get clients.
That does make selling houses challenging.
It does. But when I went to treatment back in 2000, I got plugged in doing some community service at the National Council on Alcohol and Drug Dependence of Jackson, Mississippi. And there I was introduced to what they did, which was a lot of prevention and intervention and working with kids in schools. I volunteered there for quite a bit, and then they hired me. And a year sober, they got me trained in teaching life skills. I still laugh at that, but I was in the midst of learning them myself.
Yeah, sure.
But I would go to these alternative schools and these really, really rough schools and talk to the kids, and I just connected with them.
Yeah. I think it's better to a certain extent, too, though, to have a person newer in sobriety. And like you said, you were just learning life skills mm-hmm. yourself. But to me, that makes you more relatable. Like, I feel like once you get into long-term sobriety, like, I'm not the most relatable person for the brand new person anymore, you know?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
The person with a few months or, you know, certainly under a year, like, that's the perfect person to be talking to people that are just starting.
And I loved those kids. Those kids were, you know, they had some really bad situations. They were in a school that I had never seen before. I mean, they got searched going in. I mean, not just a metal detector, but they would get full-blown searched going
like
in.
Like physically searched.
Physically searched, oh, wow. Patted down, going into the school. But from there, I stayed in Jackson for about almost my first 2 years of sobriety. And then I came back and I got, I joined the Dallas Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse and worked there for just about a decade. A little under 10 years I worked there.
What were you doing there?
I started there in the classroom as well. And then I started to run the Prevention Resource Center. Then I worked with drug endangered children, helping kids that are living in dangerous drug environments. And then I managed their youth prevention programs, all of them. And so by the time I left there, I had done a little bit of everything.
Did you feel like even in your early sobriety, when you were still in Mississippi, did you feel like it was your calling? Like, did you feel passionate about doing that work?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, I think I knew when I first started to volunteer at the National Council. They just took me in and really like took me under their wing. And this lady, Patsy, who has become like my second mother, really believed in me. And yeah. I just was passionate about what she did and saw her passion. And
so at Windhaven House, do you have a minimum and maximum length of stay?
We do. We have a minimum. Our minimum stay is 90 days. We want a 90-day commitment. I don't believe that we can do a whole lot of work with them if they're not there at a minimum of 90 days. The maximum, I mean, we've had somebody stay as long as 14 months. It depends on the individual person, you know, to complete our program. They're in our program, I would say, anywhere from 9 months to over a year.
That's so good. But at different stages, they get more freedom, so to speak, and more responsibilities back. So they're really transitioning.
Yeah, they're the first phase. When we have a three-phase system, the first phase is obviously the most restricted phase. They go to IOP. So they're in group 5 days a week on phase one. They go to IOP 3 days a week. They have an individual session with their counselor once a week. And then there's the two Windhaven groups that I was talking about earlier. So they're really busy. They have to get a sponsor and get through their first 5 steps before they can move on to phase two. We help them get sponsors. We'll suggest a few people to them that we know would be a good fit for them, that we know have worked all 12 steps and then have done the work early.
I feel like this sponsorship thing, I feel like it almost becomes a bigger issue than it needs to be. So I have this conversation pretty regularly in my sober livings too, right? Where because the guys in my sober livings are required to work with a sponsor. But I feel like they get hung up on like who to pick, you know, and I'm in this conversation literally almost weekly where I'm like, listen, remember, number one, you're not marrying the person. We're not getting married, you know, and as a sponsor, like you can break up with me whenever you want to, you know, like it's just important that you start that process. And I think some of them are afraid to ask, you know, they get nervous about that part of it. But it's like they create this thing where they have to pick the perfect person. And like, this is going to be the person I work with for the next 50 years. And, you know, I'm like, no, dude, just ask somebody and start working. You can figure out the rest as you go.
Exactly. It is the same thing with the women in our program. It's finding that perfect sponsor, the person, you know, and that's why we help them. And we kind of will guide them and say, look, these are the people that we think will be really good for you. Mm-hmm. They might have similar stories. They're on fire. We want to pick the best possible person for them. I will tell you, when I first opened, we didn't help them pick their sponsors. Mm-hmm. And I would ask them, well, what made you pick this person? And she'd be like, well, I really liked what she was wearing.
Right.
And so once I started to hear that same trend over and over, I was like, you know, we're going to really help them and do with the people we know are doing the work.
Yeah.
And have done the work and that are going to hold them accountable for doing the work. But they do look at it like that. And I think I did the same thing. I remember the first time I broke up with a sponsor, it felt like I was breaking up with somebody.
Yeah.
And I made it into something bigger than it's not. And I really try to normalize that for our women, because they do get nervous if it's not working out, or they're going to hurt them.
Yeah.
That they're like this really important person in their life. And for me, I've been around a while, I've been broken up with quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I don't ever take it personally. If somebody wants to enlarge their spiritual life and it's not happening with me, man, more power to them. Go for it.
Yeah. And I try to, on the sponsor side, if I feel like something isn't going well, if I feel like there's some rift, like, you know, when you're not really connecting with somebody or they're not really connecting with you. So I try to open that conversation. I just had this conversation not very long ago with a girl I sponsor. And I said, you know, is there something you're looking for that you're not getting from me? You know, is there something you want to be doing that we haven't talked about? Because I want that relationship to be valuable. And sometimes it gets challenging, you know, so I love having that ongoing conversation. A couple of times I have tried a similar thing in suggesting people. Again, because I've been in the Kansas City recovery community a long time, so I know a lot of people. And sometimes it's really easy for me when somebody moves into one of my houses, like it will just click in my head, oh my gosh, so-and-so would be the perfect fit for this guy. But what I found was, if I would suggest one person and maybe they would connect and talk a little bit and decide that wasn't the best person for them, then they would just come back to me to pick again. So I just felt like they got a little lackadaisical in their approach when I was helping them.
That's a good point. I don't know that we've had that issue. More than anything is, if the person that we've picked doesn't work out, they'll come to us and say, well, who do you think? Or I saw so-and-so in a meeting and I really like them. Do you know them? What do you think about them? And so we'll leave that dialogue open.
Yeah.
Like that.
I think that's the most important part of it too, is just that it's an open, ongoing conversation.
Absolutely.
Because everybody's not going to have the perfect fit right out the gate. That's not always the case.
I don't know that there is a perfect fit. You know, I look for, you know, my sponsor is somebody that I adore and love her program and love the life that she's gotten as a result of working a program and the peace and serenity. So that's what I strive for.
Right. I had a very different situation, because when I was brand new, I knew in within my first couple of meetings, I knew exactly who I wanted to be my sponsor, but it was a man. And in 12-step programs, it is common women work with women and men work with men. And there is this sort of divide. And that is changing somewhat now. I see it a lot more now than I did certainly, you know, 12 years ago. But that's who I wanted. And I knew that's who I wanted. And everybody said women work with women, men work with men. So I just kept quiet, you know, and I was like, okay, I just have to figure it out. And I don't really know what I was thinking. I don't know what I thought was going to happen. I just knew that was the person that I wanted. And I did a fourth and fifth step, and I had a lady in my group go through that with me because I wanted to be sober, right? And I was really following all the suggestions. Everything they said to do, I was doing it. I was in 150%. I did not want to drink. You could not pay me $1 million to drink. I just wanted a different life. So I wanted to do everything, and I wanted to do it to the best of my ability. But I knew who I wanted to be my sponsor, and I was told that I couldn't have that person. So when I was 10 months sober, I was talking to him in a speaker meeting one night, and I had purchased a 12-step workbook, and it was in my bag. And he saw it, and he goes, "What's that?" And I said, "Well," I said, "I feel like I have to sponsor myself, so I want to make sure that I have that I'm working the steps. Like, I want to make sure I'm doing a good job." And he looked at me, and he goes, "I'll be your sponsor." And I was like, "What? I thought we couldn't do that." And he said, "You need a sponsor. I'll be your sponsor." And I mean, it was the most incredible moment because that's who I had wanted the whole time. And he was one of the people that I got sober at a noon meeting. And I always talk about I had three guys at the noon meeting every day. I couldn't wait to get there. I loved these three guys. And I couldn't wait to get there every day and tell him I was still sober. And he was one of them. And my whole sobriety changed at that point. And we worked together for 9 years. And still, to a large degree, he's still my go-to person. When something big happens, he is almost always my first call. And it was just a great relationship for me. Now, I definitely understand how that wouldn't be the best situation for somebody else. It's just what worked for me. And I'm so grateful that it worked out that way because it changed my whole sobriety, having that good, strong, supportive person that knew how to communicate with me, that could really hold me accountable, you know, because I have a pretty strong personality and can be a little bit of a bully myself, certainly when I was less healthy. So, yeah, I do think that getting someone that you connect with is important, but I don't think that that always happens with your first choice necessarily. Does that make sense?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, my first sponsor was my sponsor in treatment, and they treatment center picked her to hear my fifth step, and I had no idea. I mean, I was so new, I didn't even really know what her role was. And she stayed my sponsor for like 3 months. I just stopped. I mean, I didn't know what I was doing. And I had met this other lady that ended up being my, you know, my real first sponsor. And I worked with her for a while until I moved back to Dallas. And actually for about a year after I moved back to Dallas, I think it's who you can connect with, who you feel the most comfortable with telling your whole story to and not leaving anything out, and that can hold you accountable and that you're going to hear something from, you know. Now, sometimes like the women in our homes, I would have to maybe question their motives if they wanted a man to sponsor them.
Yes.
But, you know, I've had friends that have been sponsored by men that a guy that just died like 3 or 4 years ago. He was this just old timer that really we all looked up to, and he sponsored one of my dear friends. And yeah. So
I do see it more frequently now. And that was, you know, especially being that many years ago, it definitely had its challenges. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I faced a lot of adversity in my group. There were a lot of women in my group that were not happy with my choice. And those were things that I just had to deal with, you know, because I knew it was the right fit for me. I also knew, you know, he had conversation with me from the very beginning about, so he said, we will always be very public when we meet. We will meet at the group, at the church where our group is. We will always be in front of people. You know, we won't be doing standard sponsy things where, you know, I'm going to your house for coffee or things like that. You know, I mean, it just the boundaries were very, very clear from the first minute. And
I think that's so important. And even with the same gender, having the boundaries set up front are so important.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's people that I've sponsored for several years that, you know, the relationship grows.
Of course. Yeah, you do get really close, mm-hmm. for sure. And a lot of growth, you know, and I get to see that now that I've been sober a while. where you get to see the people, especially having sober living, where you get to see people come in new and you get to see that transformation. And it's so amazing to me to watch. And I have people in my group that say the same thing about me, you know, how they've watched my transformation. And it's one of the most rewarding parts of sobriety, I think, is getting to see all of us grow.
Absolutely. Better than any drug ever is watching somebody's eyes come from being dead to alive. I don't think there's a better feeling in the world.
See people get confident. That's what I love, is when you see somebody start to calm down a little bit, get comfortable in their skin. Such a great feeling.
It is. We have the best job in the world.
Yeah, I agree.
I just, you know, and the hardest. I mean, we've got some people that don't make it, that leave and they end up dying. I mean, I've had to see a lot of people die. You know, I think the longer that you stay sober, the more people you also see that don't make it.
Yeah, of course.
That just stop doing the work. They just stop doing it.
Emotionally, it is very hard work. It's not all the joy and getting to see people grow, because, you know, we have a lot of hurdles to overcome. So it can be really, really challenging too, and challenging working with families and trying to help them get through stuff and understand things. And as addicted people, you know, we have a charming personality.
Very charming. And I think you hit it. The families can be really difficult to work with. I know for us, because we do a lot of work with families and we're in a lot of contact with them and really encouraging them to get their own program and work on themselves is a challenge, because a lot of the time they don't see that there's anything that they've done. The addict, and that if the addict just did right, that they wouldn't, and they don't see that codependency and they don't see that cycle. And it's, for me, it's probably the most challenging part of my job.
No, I would agree with that for sure. I always say that when I do interventions too, like, it doesn't do us any good to send the person away to get treatment just to come home to the same broken system. Like, exactly. Everybody has to get some help, because it is, even if I'm the addicted person, well, that's great. So I'm a recovering alcoholic. So my addiction is alcohol, but the family's addiction becomes keeping the addicted person alive, you know, and they have their own addiction in there and codependence. And it's a lot to untangle. But yeah, I would agree. It is one of the more challenging parts.
And then they'll have their demands on what they want to see happen while they're here, and how we need to do our job, which can be challenging, you know. And I just try to really, you know, nudge them back to maybe working an Al-Anon or a Families Anonymous program, and really trying to kind of stay on their side of the street.
I love when I get asked, which I get more than I ever thought I would. It's kind of funny, but when families will say, when do they get to that part where they do the apologizing? Like, when does that happen?
I get that too.
Like, well, it's different for everybody. But let's worry about where we are right now and we'll get there, you know. But yeah, it is. They do kind of have their own ideas. But it's funny, because as addicted people, we have our own ideas too, how we think it should go. And, you know, I have all these ideas about what level of healing I should be at. I should be better than this by now, or I should be able to do this by now. Yeah, we all have our own ideas of what it should look like.
Oh, yeah. And I was that way too. I remember being about 6 months sober and being in sober living. And I thought, well, it's time for me to move on. And I was court ordered, so I didn't get to, and I'm really glad that I didn't get to, because I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
But I do. I think we get a little bit of sobriety and we start feeling better and we start looking better and we think, okay, I can do this now on my own. I think one of the things as an addict myself is that I need these daily disciplines and I need to do them as long as possible, that time is my friend.
Yes.
If I, you know, I leave prematurely, I do something that I'm not quite ready for, and I relapse, then I got to start all over if I make it back.
Right.
And so I think that's a great point. As addicts, we also have our own, you know, agenda of, well, you know, and I'll get it all the time though. Well, I'm just coming for 90 days because that's all that I said I was going to do with my parents. I need to get on with my life. I got to go back to school. I've got to.
Yeah,
gotta,
that's
do
a
this,
big
this,
one.
And this.
Like, we decide we're ready to start making up for lost time.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't even have the skills. I mean, it took a while before I even had the basic foundational skills to be able to go to school or even to have a real job because I couldn't be on time. I couldn't even do that. You know, I couldn't manage my time and wake up on time and get out of the house on time to be at a job on time. I couldn't even pull that off. But we do, we get in a hurry and it's like, well, now I have to go. Okay, I've been sober 90 days. You know, I've got to get the CEO job or, you know, a full-time school schedule and a full-time job. And yeah, we get way ahead of ourselves.
We do. And it's, you know, and I think it's normal and natural for us to, because we feel better to think that I'm very guilty of that. I thought I was further along than I was.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that I stayed and did what was suggested for me to do, because I don't know if I would have relapsed or if I wouldn't have. But I know that doing what I was told to do has kept me sober to this day.
And you're exactly right. It is about feeling better, because you get to that space, you feel so much better. Like I know in my first few months sober, like obviously I hadn't even had a clear head in years. I hadn't woken up without a hangover in years, you know, so you feel better and you want to get a jump start on your new life. So this is my favorite question I ask everybody. What is your favorite thing about being a sober person?
My favorite thing about being a sober person is, I think, being a sober mom.
Aw.
You know, I did not have a sober mom, and my mom died before I got sober, and my daughter has never seen me drink. And I think just being present for my family has been the biggest gift, because I didn't get to see that in my mom.
Or having the ability to even recognize that, right? When I was drinking, I wouldn't even be capable of recognizing I wasn't present in the moment. That's a sober thing.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things about being sober that, I mean, being responsible, I couldn't show up for anything. I couldn't even show up for my own birthday party and not be 3 to 4 hours late for my own birthday party.
Yeah.
I mean, I just was really irresponsible and inconsiderate. And I think also just thinking of other people besides myself has been the biggest things, you know, that
for the general public, that doesn't seem to be so challenging. For addicted people, that is challenging.
Right.
Yeah, I think being dependable also is one of my favorite things. Like knowing that people can count on me. You know, when I say I'm going to be there, I will be there. When I say I'm going to call, I'm going to call. And sometimes I catch myself too. I start to recognize where I'm getting too busy and I'm overextending myself, because little things start to fall through the cracks. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. You know, like I'll forget to call somebody back or something like that. Even with my podcast, like I have certain deadlines with my podcast. Like I have to have certain things done by certain days, you know, to stay on top of everything, and I'll miss a deadline. You know, I won't get an episode through post-production the day I'm supposed to. You know, when I start not being dependable, that's when I know I've way overextended myself and I have to back up, because I have the natural inclination. I want to help and I want to say yes, and I want to be there for everybody, you know?
I have the same problem. Overextending myself, doing more than not delegating, I want to take everything on myself. It's exhausting.
I might have some of that. I like being really hands-on, though, especially in my business. I like being hands-on.
And I think my favorite part of being a sober woman is modeling that for the women in my homes and connecting with them. I mean, that's the thing I like about my program is I connect with every single woman that comes through the house. I'm not just the owner. I'm the person that's in there.
Love that. Yes. I'm the same way. I'm so connected to those guys.
Yeah. I'll pick them up and I'll just show up there with my daughter. One night we showed up and I was like, let's go get popsicles. And we took everybody to get popsicles and then went back to the house and played games with them. But that's really important to me.
Yeah. Me too. Me too. We do family style dinner once a month.
We do Friday nights.
Yeah. I love it. It's so good though. It sounds like such a simple thing, but it's just kind of a magical thing that we can all just sit down and eat together and just relax and have fun. And my houses are a lot of fun anyway. Like I actually put kind of an emphasis on having fun, because I feel like it's one of the pieces of sobriety that gets overlooked. Like it's such serious business, you know, getting sober, and we forget that we have to have fun, especially the younger people coming in, and again, them being connected to one another and doing things together and being out in the community and My guys are required to do service work every month too. Like, we're always out giving back. It's just so important to for them to start to see the full lifestyle they can have as a sober person, and they can enjoy themselves and be laughing and just have a nice life, you know?
And being part of a community. And I think that's really important is connecting and being part of the community and the homes and then that you live in.
Yeah.
Outside of the homes. Our programs seem to be really similar because we do the same thing. We serve lunch to the homeless on Fridays. We also, Friday night is called family night, and they do something fun. We do, you know, it says in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're not a glum lot. And I really like to emphasize that with the women that come through, because ours typically tend to be young adult women that come to our program. And I know I got sober at 30, at 31 actually, and to think that my life was over, that I was never going to have fun again, were one of the thoughts that I had at 30 or 31 years old.
Yeah, imagine at 20 or 22. That's a lot to think about.
Yeah. And I've had more fun in sobriety than I ever had.
Way more fun.
I've had so much fun. I got married in Cabo, a sober wedding, to another alcoholic, a recovering alcoholic.
Because actually, now,
a recovered alcoholic.
Because now I can actually do all the things that I want to do. Where when I was drunk, I would just talk about it. I couldn't follow through. You know, like I could never. I'm a traveler, love to travel. And that's something when I was drinking, I would always talk about all the places I wanted to go and all the places I wanted to see. But I could barely drive down the street. You know what I mean?
Neither could I. And I probably, get out the front door.
I probably shouldn't have been driving down the street. But yeah, now I get to do all of those things, you know, and I've traveled the world. I'm a scuba diver and I've gone all over the place diving. Like, it's incredible. I never would have been able to do that stuff if I was still drinking.
Yeah, that's amazing. It is. It's fun. Life is fun.
Well, thank you so much again for doing this with me. It has been such a pleasure to spend some time with you and get to know you a little bit. Let everybody know how they can find you and Windhaven.
They can go on our website at windhavenhouse.com. There's a call button, or they can call me 972-948-2612.
And I will put all of that stuff in the show notes too, so you guys can find it at addictionunlimited.com. Again, thank you so much, Allison. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
You've reached the end of another great episode of the Addiction Unlimited podcast, candid and honest conversation about addiction and recovery. Be sure to visit us at addictionunlimited.com to join the conversation and access show notes and links to everything we talked about. Love this episode? Please take 30 seconds to subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes to help us improve and give you the information you want. Thanks for listening. See you next week.